Parami here, and this evening I'm sitting on a sofa again. This time with Kasamati, a Dharmacharini who lives in New Zealand, in Thames, and Tejapala, who's a Kiwi but lives in Melbourne, in Australia. And I'm Scottish, but I live in England, and I'm visiting Australia. So we've just come to the end of the area convention here in Australia, which is an area convention for Australia and New Zealand, an area which used to be called Australasia, and then it became South Pacific, but on this convention, some of us at least think it might be called Oceania, but we're not quite sure. Anyway, do you want to just introduce yourselves, say hello, just say a little bit about yourself? Kasamati's eaten, so we'll start with Tejapala.
Hello, I'm Tejapala. As Parami said, I live in Melbourne. I have lived around the centres in Auckland and Wellington, at Sudarshan Loka Retreat Centre in New Zealand, and also by the London Buddhist Centre in the early 2000s for a few years.
Mm. Hi there, I'm Kasamati. I've just moved back to Thames from living in Australia at a place called Naganaga for 5 years, which is a rural vihara. The women there try and live sustainably as possible, run retreats and have facilities for solitary retreats. So that's where I've been, and now I'm re-establishing myself back in New Zealand.
Great, thank you. So partly why I wanted to have this chat conversation with both of you this evening was because this afternoon Tejapala and myself, helping him, we did a workshop on looking at climate change. And Kasamati, I know it's also a great love of yours. Mm. So I just thought it would be quite nice for people to hear a little bit about what we did this afternoon. So Tejapala, do you want to just say a bit about even maybe the genesis of why you felt it was important to...
Oh, okay. That's
a bit of a big question, yeah.
Why is that important? Yeah. I guess I've been thinking about this for something like 15 years or so. It's affected my practice in various ways and my reflections on Dharma practice. It's a big question. I guess one of the things that comes up when you start talking to order members and mitras about climate change is, well, what's that got to do with the Dharma? So, I couldn't really say much more than that apart from, you know, something of a personal and a professional history in the area. One of the things that influenced it, at least, was last year I trained along with about 500 other people here in Australia with Al Gore in giving his now pretty famous slideshow presentation on the subject. So it's the area I work in. So I wanted to try and kick off a bit more of an initiative of this in this area within our movement.
Great.
So one of the things we looked at was what's it got to do with the Dharma?
So one of the things, well, the workshop itself had various bits to it, but one of the bits was we did what's known as a fishbowl discussion,
yeah,
where a small number of us are sitting in a circle having a conversation with each other, and the other people in the room are just listening initially to that, and then there's a space for them to come in and participate. So, Kasamati, you came in at one point to participate in that, and I think it was when we were talking about transition towns.
Mm.
So, I mean, that was, people were very interested when you started to talk about that. So, could you maybe say a little bit about what that is? Because maybe not everybody will know.
Mm. Yeah, I did have a bit of a rave about transition towns because it's my current favourite topic. I just think it's a fantastic initiative. It was started in England, in Totnes, down in Devon, by a permaculture teacher. And his initial concern was about peak oil, but he also realised that they couldn't really be climate change and peak oil couldn't be separated as issues, and that he wanted to encourage people to look at their communities in a way that would make them or develop them into resilient communities that could, face any difficulties in the future. But more than that, that would actually be a fun and interesting and engaging and you know, good development anyway. So, yeah, and that movement has spread quite widely, quite quickly in the UK and now internationally. And, yeah, many places, big and small, villages, towns, cities, are trying to follow those methods.
Mm. And you've been involved in the transition town in Thames, where you live?
Yeah.
Are you getting involved?
Yeah. I'm fairly new there, so I've only been to a couple of meetings. But I think they've been going since about 2008 or something, and they've done some good things, like getting lots of fruit and nut trees planted in the local areas, council land, and two electric car chargers, public electric car chargers, and they've got a good relationship with the local council, so things are developing.
That's in a town of 7,000 people, just to put that in perspective.
And really good waste management. That they started the Seagull Centre, which is a fantastic recycling centre.
Yeah. What, you recycle seagulls?
The seagulls sit on the roof
and watch the
recycle. It's just stuff that comes out of the rubbish stream. But they've raised heaps of money for the community just through selling, you know, junk that people throw away and they kind of haul out and put on shelves and people pay money for.
Great.
Yeah. And people love it in Thames, you know, if you want anything, you just go down to the Seagull Centre.
I want to come back to transition towns, actually, because there was something that you said just at the end of the fishbowl session, so I'll come back to that. But just going back to Ejipala, so you decided you wanted to run a workshop or something.
Yeah.
People seemed very open to that happening.
Yeah.
And I agreed to come in just to help with the facilitation as much as anything. So do you want to just say a little bit about what the structure was, what we did?
Sure.
We had about an hour and a half.
Yeah, we had about an hour and a half, and we spent the first maybe 45 minutes or so. First of all, Parami introduced the session and really put it in terms of the whole question of climate change and the Dharma, and looking at it in terms of the practice of metta and the figure of Avalokiteshvara. And then we could say quite a lot more about that, but I mean, I then did a 45 minute or so presentation, which was the Al Gore presentation slightly modified. And really that was just saying, so what is the issue? I mean, the five sort of key messages that you usually come across are, you know, it's real. I don't think there's too many people who would say it doesn't exist.
Realising climate change
is a real thing. There are still places in the world where people actually outright question the reality of whether climate change is happening. And then there's the it's us, which means it's caused by human beings. Sometimes it's tempting to say it's not caused by human beings. There's this variation in the weather. And the next one was it's bad. And I do quite a lot on the it's bad message. And what that means, essentially some of the key things in there were like the fact that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is saying if the temperature increases by, say, as much as 4 degrees above sort of pre-industrial levels, we're talking about a large percentage of all species on Earth being extinct by the end of the century, which is extremely serious. And there are a number of other almost as serious effects. And then
it's the third one.
And then the fourth one is scientists agree. And if you would find it almost impossible to find a major scientific organisation or a peer-reviewed climate scientist who doesn't agree that climate change is bad and caused by humans. And then the last one is that there is hope. And there's an awful lot that you could say about that. There's a lot of positive things going on right now, which often people lose sight of.
So what I took from what you've just said, but also how the workshop went, and your presentation, was maybe focusing particularly on the it's bad.
Yes.
And there's hope.
Yeah.
Which is great to get both of them. Well, it's not great that it's bad, but given that it is bad and that message was coming across partly in your slides, it's great that you were able to also then go into things that you feel are still hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, there is a school of thought who thinks it's too late.
Sure. And it's not. I mean, the simple math on this is that there's so many, about 500 to 1,000 billion tonnes more carbon dioxide we can put into the atmosphere before we cross a critical threshold, which is a 2-degree increase. And a lot of things get a lot worse if you cross somewhere between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And we haven't done that yet. I mean, we're very close. We're putting about 40 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year as a species. So that's you know, very scary stuff. But we're not there yet. Mm. And there's a lot of things going on to try and bring that down. It just, the thing is, it has to happen now. Mm. We've got about 10 to 15 years to bring that down. Because if we keep on emitting it at the rates that we are, we will go past that threshold.
Yeah, I was struck by somebody saying, well, I think you said it yourself, Tejapala, but also one of the other Dharmacharinis here, talking about looking at her grandchildren.
Sure.
And, of course, you know, that is something that often we say. It's like looking at that generation. So her grandchildren are, well, some of them are older, but she's got a couple, I think, who are toddlers, still quite wee. Mm. And you were saying yourself, Tejapala, being with some friends recently who've got a fairly wee under 2-year-old, toddler.
Yeah, that's great.
And thinking, well, by the time that wee boy leaves high school, we've either blown it or we've done something to try and reduce.
That is the time frame, you know. Yeah. By the time your child grows up, that's pretty much it.
Mm, which is quite.
So can I just ask you, Tejapala, so we need to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere very quickly, but we also need to find ways to sequester carbon, take out what is already in the atmosphere?
Yes, I mean, we probably do, not as an alternative to reducing.
As well as.
Mm. And that comes with its own problems, because the ways that you do that are only ever, they're only as good as however long the forest lasts that you plant. Or the soil sequestration that you put in place has to, the carbon has to stay locked in.
Mm.
So the best thing you can do is prevent what they call fossil carbon, that's the coal, oil and gas carbon locked up in that, from ever entering the atmospheric cycle in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other thing that we spoke about, though, was the, so what's this got to do with the Dharma, which, you know, people listening to this might be
Thinking the same thing,
is that that's fine, it's all very well, but, you know, aren't other people doing something about that?
Mm. Mm. Yeah, and somebody who came into the circle of the fishbowl also said, you know, that the Dharma's, I don't want to paraphrase and simplify because it was a bit more sophisticated than that, but that what we've got unique to offer the world, we as Tree Ratna, is the Dharma.
Mm.
So shouldn't we be concentrating on teaching the Dharma and helping people to work with, you know, work individually with their ethical practice and things? So, you know, I mean, what was your answer to that? What would your answer be to that?
Up to a certain point, I have a great deal of sympathy with that point of view, but only up to a certain point. I mean, first of all, in the context that we're talking about, essentially trying to do something in a very urgent time frame to prevent something equivalent to maybe a limited nuclear war. I mean, that's that the only thing I can think of it as serious as this.
Hmm.
And we're kind of just steadily marching towards those consequences at the moment. I just can't see that you could say that somehow that doesn't have anything to do with, say, the first precept or metta, or even the fact that a lot of what we do, you know, if I fly a lot and if I do certain things, that will have consequences I don't see, but they nonetheless are real. So there's, even on the level of conditionality up to a point, and so, I mean, there's that. So, you know, there's the sort of what do you mean by the Dharma anyway?
Mm.
And then there's, I guess you'd also say, well, if you're talking about the path to enlightenment, obviously, then it's very hard to do that on a planet that's, you know, seriously in trouble. Mm. And also, how can we practice towards enlightenment when we're kind of ignoring so much suffering? The last thing is, that I guess we have to kind of, I think we have to kind of have a two-speed approach to this. One is the very long-term vision that Bhante's always spoken about, which is trying to build the new society within the old. And that's a very long-term project. And he essentially says that that's what the future of the world really ultimately depends on. But then we've got the next 10 to 15 years to kind of get through some really tight hoops.
Mm.
And we don't have time to build a new society in that time. Mm. It's just not going to happen.
Mm.
So in that time, I think there's an urgency that I think Buddhists need to get involved with.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's not an either or. You know, I think sometimes we can polarise really easily about this, and it's sort of, as though we're going to give up teaching the Dharma to go on lots of climate marches, but it's not. It's an expression of our practice and could be completely integral to both our personal practice and what we do in our institutions. Mm. And we could model something quite, quite radical, because we have got the community base, haven't we? The Sangha is a fantastic organism, and there's a basis for real positive action there.
And also, I'd be the first to say that it's very, very important that to not do what perhaps a lot of climate activists do, the number of people I know do, which is to lose sight of your mental states.
Yeah.
And that actually this is an issue, when you spoke about polarising, it's an issue that can actually lend itself to a lot of proliferation of negative mental states. It really can. Mm. And I've certainly fallen into it, I confess. So what I need to, I think what I try to practice is, how to engage out there in the exterior world as much as possible, and as much as possible be as aware of and as, I guess, work as skillful with my own mental states as possible. Mm.
Mm. And one of the ways to frame it is that it's an incredibly exciting time to be alive. this is the crucial moment.
Cremation ground.
Yeah. It's almost like maybe humans have to sort of make an evolutionary leap in their consciousness to sort of get through this. To think more widely, to be more ethical, to really live interconnectedness, etc., etc.
Well, I had this job in Auckland recently. I was over back in New Zealand for a few months, and I was walking home one evening, and I had this distinct sense that, two things. One is that, each of us is like this kind of conduit through which, choices and therefore consequences pass, and therefore our states of mind matter an awful lot. And then second, that because of this particular issue, I really don't feel like my life is sort of, my preferences have anything to do with it. In a sense, my life's not my life, you know what I mean? It's just like, what has that got to do with it? And in a sense, I think this issue can, if I could live from that kind of experience, and I don't all the time at all, but if I could live from that, I think this issue really can bring out something akin to what Bhante's trying to communicate.
I guess compassion, it, to some extent, I don't mean that in a distant way, that we're all right, but we feel compassion for them or something, but much more the bodhisattva's compassion, which has no sense of that separateness and genuinely sees how everything I do, everything that I am involved in, is affecting everything and everybody.
Yeah, and that the idea of what our sort of personal preferences is just not the point.
So, by the end of the workshop, we were saying, or at some point we were saying, well, you need to think about this issue maybe on three levels. Yeah. So if I understood that it was like in personal level, the personal choices that we make, each and every one of us as individuals, but also our institutions, so our Buddhist centres, etc., our retreat centres, etc., how seriously are we taking this issue within our centres, and also the impact on society, the kind of broader impact.
Those three levels, and I guess it's quite interesting when you talk to people about our effect on the climate. When I talk to other Buddhists, usually the conversation starts and finishes with the first of those, my personal.
Yeah.
And partly that's the fault of the environmental movement. In the early 2000s, we spoke in those terms a lot.
Right.
But I also think there's a slight reticence sometimes to say, well, what do we do at a community level? What do we do that might actually impact society? And that reticence happens for all sorts of reasons.
Well, that's partly when I wanted to come back to something that you said, Kasimati,
about the transition towns.
About the transition towns.
Yeah, so the guy that founded that sort of realised that, trying to work at the personal level, you could do so much, but not a lot, but it was also often a sense of impotence because it was just little old me against the whole blooming problem. And then and then at the other end of the spectrum, the sort of, government and big institutions, and how can you influence them, and that's all too difficult. So the missing bit for most people was the community level, that you know, operating there is actually where people find their power. And that was part of his thinking about building resilient community, was that if you bring people together, they can act more effectively. But also just the fact that they're working together is very uplifting and empowering and enjoyable. So he was, you know, obviously operating in local communities, but we can do that too. But we also have the Sangha, which for us perhaps fills in that middle ground.
Well, we've got an extraordinarily good infrastructure.
I think our Sangha has the potential to make actually quite a substantial, probably, you know, not as big as say some other organisations in the world, but I think our Sangha as a community, I think we can really make a meaningful contribution, perhaps larger than one might think, because we have we are such an effective community. And I think the other thing I would kind of make a plea for is, I mean, people might say, so what about India in all this? You know, and I think the thing is, to be honest, you know, the effects of climate change will be felt really acutely in places like India. And, you know, if we want, I think it's up to us in Western countries to be taking this more seriously because of, you know, that because of the effects in India. And also I think the some of the solutions to this could be extremely helpful in places where, they, I mean, at the moment they're trying to get solar onto the roofs of as many homes as possible in India. And that has all sorts of other positive benefits, not least access to internet and therefore education. So I'm just, I'm not ever convinced by that argument when it comes up, by the way. But I mean, you just think that we, our whole community could make such a substantial difference on this.
Yeah, and somebody else in the circle today mentioned the second precept, which I thought was a really good point, you know, the sense of like how much we're taken out of the earth, how little we're given back. Another way of thinking about it is,
you know, like the use of resources, and in terms of, you know, there are finite resources, we're actually taking from future generations. I mean, he's put it in those terms, or pretty much.
And again, thinking of the learnings maybe from the transition town movement, you know, thinking of our own emphases that we've had in the past on residential communities, it often seems to me that although maybe less people went to live in quite that way and sent the sense of that, as we used to live in particular kind of residential communities, it still makes, to me, an awful lot of sense for people to band together and share resources and, you know, even if they're not all living under the same roof. So I was quite interested that in the other session we had this morning about what would you do with $1 million, that one of the things that came up from at least two, if not three, of the smaller groups was about eco-housing.
Yeah, and co-housing.
So, again, that's something that in the UK is becoming a bit more. There's an interest in that. And I think there is a bit more of an interest even at centre level happening, where centres are trying to be more sustainable. And you probably heard of Amala Ketu's initiative to help centres become green and get their green certificate, their carbon. That's very, very good. So there are things happening. And I think we're going to finish now, and that's been great to hear from both of you. But maybe is it just something we can say? So there might be people listening to this that just think, oh, well, that's interesting. That's what they've just done today. You know, good night and good luck. And there might be others who listen to this and think, yeah, I think that, and I don't really know what to do or where to go. So I don't mean on the level of, like, individually, like, getting solar panels and you know, maybe looking at our carbon out footprint and flying less, etc. But on a kind of institutional level, in terms of Tree Ratna as a community, I mean, given, as somebody, I think it was you, Casamati, pointed out, the Catholic Church are taking the high moral ground on this with the Pope's statement. So we're not going to have one of them, probably. But what can we do as a community? We're just sitting here, but quite a lot of people might hear this. What can we do?
I'd suggest three things.
Okay.
If you listen to this prior to the end of November, all around the world, there will be a series of protests to do with this issue, and it'll be right before the most, probably the most important meeting that will ever take place on this issue. which will be in Paris, obviously, as many people know, in early December. And I think I just encourage as many order members and mitras and friends to go out there and be visibly Buddhists together. If you, order members, perhaps even wear cases, I will be. And make your views and feelings known on this. That's the first. The other two things are, if you haven't already, then if you're an order member or a mitra who's asked for ordination, discussing what can be done on each of those three levels, the personal, the sangha, and the societal, in your chapters and going for refuge groups. And then the third one is talking to the people in the young Dharma groups that you might have, because I bet there's a lot of energy out there on this. And, you know, I think this is if we want to be taken seriously in terms of 21st century ethics, I think that's, those are the people we need to be tapping and asking, hey, what would you do?
Because
they're probably more informed than most of us.
And also they're the ones that will probably live with the consequences even more than we will. Kasimati, would you add
anything? One of the things I'd like to suggest is look into the divestment movement, because I know our order and our movement has an enormous amount of capital resources, and you know, if we use financial institutions, so we've got quite a bit of leverage there. So you know, that means basically taking money out of any investments that have anything to do with fossil fuels. So yeah, look into that, and
so that's your bank and your pension fund.
Yeah, and then do something about it, and then advertise the fact that you've done something. You know, make it public at your centre that your centre is acting on this.
Great. And I think that thing about making it public would bring it to what I think is a really important thing, is to start networking amongst order members, mitras, friends who are really interested and knowledgeable about this topic, and get together, whether it's, you know, cyberspace or get together with people in your local kind of situation, and really try and make it much more present as an issue. So, and maybe there are areas in which we can do that more publicly. And, you know, so if people listening to this are working in some way and they're interested in kind of getting together with others who are, you know, there are ways of us doing that. We know how to network.
We do. Hashtag divest Sri Ratna.
Yeah, well, that's quite good. Does that exist yet?
Just
you've
now.
Just made it. Yeah, good. Okay, thank you very much to both of you, and over and out.
Thanks, Bye. Mary.